Welcome to Weird Libertarians.
Shut up, Tyler.
Who?
Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We Are Libertarians brings you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We explain to you what the hell is happening in our world today and how we can fix it by thinking differently. Essentially, we make you sound smarter when you talk with your friends. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and subscribe on Patreon at WeAreLibertarians.com. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and freebies. We're always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@WeAreLibertarians.com. If you're new to the program, we catch up for the first 20 minutes or so, and then we deep dive into analyzing current events in society from a libertarian perspective. This show is for adults by semi-adults, so please be warned, the language is strong and offensive. With me, as always, is Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm not accustomed to sitting so close to you.
I
feel like Harry.
Well, either Kat or Harry is usually in that seat.
I'm usually on the back of the podcast.
Right. We put you way down there.
No air conditioning down on the part where I sit.
No. Listen, open a window. Crack a window yourself. You'll be fine. Also here is the legendary Tad Western. Tad, how are you?
Howdy, Chris Spangle. Greg Lenz, how are you guys doing?
The old cattle rustler.
Yep. I gotta wear this stupid headphones or I have my hat on. I don't think it may work if I hold real still.
I'm not gonna tell people if Tad Western's a real person or not.
What do you mean? I'm obviously, touch me, Greg.
I can feel
you're not dreaming. You're not dreaming. I am real.
Yes.
I'm here in the flesh.
Tad Western is here. He is ready to rustle some cattle. He has a podcast called Tad Talks. You just put one out, didn't
you?
Yeah,
I just recapped my my vacation. Myself and my cousin Aaron Ewert, who's been on the podcast many times.
Right? Has he?
Well, I don't know.
He's been around the podcast forever.
We went on a great Western adventure out to Lake Powell, Utah, and holy hell, did we have a good time.
It looked beautiful.
It is beautiful. I want to move. You want to know why I want to move? Because there is no cell service, and no one can get a hold of you, and no one bothers you.
At one point, though, Aaron drunk dialed me at 4:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday and said you were trying to commandeer a ship like Jack Sparrow. He was drunk like a teenage girl in Panama City trying to earn beads.
Well, here's the thing. We went out with, I believe there was eight of us. It was a guy's trip, and we went out to speedboat, to wakeboard. Turned out all we did was grill out, drink beer, and canyon. We just went and hiked canyons. It was the funnest shit of all time. Just went and climbed rocks and went exploring.
Have you ever seen 127 Hours?
That's where they filmed it at.
Really?
I was told. I have not seen the movie because I know the ending, and I'm like, okay, this isn't that good.
Yeah, I saw that little one-armed bastard do an interview on NBC.
I was like,
not impressed.
You didn't even die. Like, come on. Like, I need more struggling than that. I watched Game of Thrones, and like, come on.
That surfer girl already did this. This is just too much.
Yeah. I mean, that was a shark. That wasn't a rock. You lost your arm to an inanimate object. It's just... It was too tight.
Nobody likes to try hard.
Yeah, right. I mean, come on, bro.
Exactly.
Come on, bro.
Well, it's great to have you here. We're excited to have you here at the We Are Libertarians Empire.
I'm excited to be here. It's been a while since I've seen you two in person. I apologize for missing your birthday.
You should.
I brought Graces.
Okay, good.
Well, your cats already ate them.
That's fine.
I brought you sardines, but they knocked everything off the table and they ate it off the floor.
Tad is a single man. You're a single bachelor, right?
Yeah, by choice.
Right.
Now, I've got ladies lining up. The ranch, the reason the driveway is so long is so all the cars can just park up there, and then they get up the gate and I say, who are you? State your purpose and what you're
here for. Here's an application.
Yeah.
And he was regaling us with tales of heading over to the old Coachman in Plainfield and rustling up some waitresses.
Oh, the Coachman. I'm pretty sure I was born a 58-year-old man.
Yeah.
Like, I feel so at home around old people, and they're just so easygoing, and they just... I don't know. I want to just be retired. That's my goal in life.
You pretty much are there.
I am there.
Tad, he is your uncle that just drinks beer and shit talks during Thanksgiving dinner.
I do. I like to rustle shit. It's not even I like drinking. I like drinking in social circles or around people.
Right.
Number one, I get anxiety really bad. So
right.
I can't be around too many people I don't know without a beer in my hand.
Right.
But if I have a beer in my hand, I'm the life of the party.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like an on and off switch. It's just, it is how it is.
You, well, it's great to have you here. We're so excited that you're back.
I love what you've done with the place, by the way. Thank you to all the Patreon subscribers and everybody who's...
Jeff Vibbert from the Jeff Vibbert podcast, formerly of the Bob and Tom Show, now of Barstool Heartland. Vibbert literally FaceTimes me every single time we're doing a live podcast. It's amazing.
It's almost as if I know when you're podcasting.
And you're just being a little shit.
Jeff Vibbert became famous and he threw away all of his t-shirts. He FaceTimed me 3 days ago. And neither one of us had a shirt.
I want to run through the halls of my high school.
I want to hold a puppy in my kitchen.
So, Jeff, thank you for FaceTiming us shirtless. We wanted to say hello. I always feel...
The dog switched foods. Get out of there.
The dog switched foods. Very exciting. We will talk to you sooner rather than later. I just feel bad because I never answer his FaceTimes when he calls because he always... I know he's picking the most inopportune time. And then he, on the back end, goes, you didn't answer my FaceTime. It's like, you knew I was podcasting and you did it on purpose to make me
I wasn't going to eat this bleach popsicle, but then you didn't answer.
It's almost like he's a comedian and a dick.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. We wanted to have good old Tad Western here tonight because it is...
Am I being served a warrant?
Yes, you are. We wanted to have Tad Western here because, Tad, you are a big Trump fan.
I'm a fan of his shit post. I'm not a fan. I didn't vote for Trump. I've went over this 100 times.
Right.
The reason I didn't vote for Trump is because I knew the state I voted in was going to vote for Trump anyway, because
right.
He selected Mike Pence, so I was like, okay, he's going to win.
Yeah.
And I predicted that me and Greg, I think, were the first one. And maybe Rob Kendall, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think we predicted that a long time
ago.
Rob
needed meaning. You two just thought he was funny. Rob needs something in his life.
I saw the trifecta. He had 100% brand recognition. Number two, he didn't give a shit, and he had nothing to lose other than... his brand, but he didn't. He's a master manipulator, and if you read The Art of the Deal, you know exactly what he was doing from the beginning. And me and Greg had many conversations about this, but once he applied that to politics, which no one had ever seen in history, it was a game set match.
It was sort of it was the perfect storm, if you will, much like what would look like in the Caribbean and the Gulf Coast. Is sort of a George Clooney perfect storm scenario that's transpiring right now. That is what happened with Donald Trump in American
yes.
politics.
Oh, and I forget that everybody was pissed off at the establishment and everybody who was running. So, I mean, that played into his cards. But Trump had been feeling this out since 2001. I mean, or 2000, if you remember.
When he was the reform nominee.
Yeah, reform.
Or he won what the Illinois primary is, the reform nominee.
Yeah.
All right, before we get back to Trump, Vibbert called and left a voicemail. And knowing Jeff, this is going to be funny. So let's play it.
He mentions my mother.
This is Jeff Vibbert. You're probably podcasting right now. I'm trying to call in and request a complaint. I'm real tired of you, and I want you to get kicked off your own podcast. So I think the listeners would agree. I'm tired of you. Have a good day now.
I feel like I shouldn't have played that. That was rude. I hate that little bastard. Funny kid. Check him out on Barstool Heartland on the Pat McAfee Show. I don't know why I'm plugging Pat McAfee's podcast, because he's like number 30 in iTunes and we're like number 500, but hey, whatever.
Yeah, so, we're not salty.
Right.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
So Donald Trump has...
Anybody can punt. Can you do a libertarian podcast and make it funny?
Exactly right.
That's what I thought.
Only one. One podcast.
We all know Pat closes for Jeff. So,
that's right.
I mean, come on.
So Donald Trump has had a really interesting week or two as president. It's almost like he's starting to kind of gel as president of the United States a little bit and feel his oats. He had dinner with Chuck and Nancy and worked on several deals on immigration, on health care, and then this week went to the UN and gave his first speech to the UN, and I felt like it was one of the clearest articulations of a lot of the policies that he kind of talks about, but he's inarticulate. So
he's never going to be the orator. You know, like, that's the real thing to remember. And that was the real thing I always felt why so many people disliked him, was because he was such a different style to follow up the guy that was probably the greatest modern orator in American politics, in Barack Obama.
Do you feel like you can be an intelligent person if you don't have a range of vocabulary?
I absolutely do. Guys like Richard Branson, someone who's dyslexic and so couldn't excel in, you know, traditional schooling.
Right.
He had to learn to, you know, figure things out. And when you hear him speak, he clearly doesn't have this, you know, expansive vocabulary, but he can get to like the core and foundational principles instantaneously.
Right.
And that's what they said a lot about George Bush, is that in a room where he was comfortable and not going to stumble all over himself, he was a dynamo. But then the second you put cameras up, it was like he learned how to stutter.
Right. Yeah. Tad, what do you think?
Oh, about what? Donald Trump's speeches?
His style. His oratorical style.
Do you think that Donald Trump is an intelligent person?
Yeah, there's many ways to value intelligence. I mean, intelligence is, okay, maybe you're street smart, maybe you're book smart. But as far as orating goes, Barack Obama was a stud on that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell, you could never tell when he was off the cuff or when he was reading a speech, to be honest with you. Trump, it's completely different because he starts tweeting when he goes off the cuff. You know? I mean, he's a rocket man. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to that in a little bit. But
yeah.
But that's Donald Trump's style, and it has been since the freaking 80s. I mean, he's been gold in New York tabloids forever.
Greg is currently laughing at his own meme.
I just thought, like, if you had told me
that's what you call softball.
That the last time that there was this kind of, you know, sort of this sort of collapse in decorum at the UN was when Hugo Chavez started sniffing like he smelled sulfur after speaking after George W. Bush. And so you don't get many funny, you know, sort of off the cuff instances when you're addressing the UN. And so for Donald Trump to really give his best speech, his most serious commander, you know, well articulated, like you said, you know, very well laid out, thoughtful, coherent set of policies, and in a very presidential tone, he just couldn't resist the urge to call the Hermit Kingdom leader Rocket Man. And that's what I love, because at the end of the day, say what you will about, you know, he's definitely, you know, the compromiser. He's very much representative of the great moderation of American society and politics.
Right.
However, we have a political podcast, and I needed, it isn't easy to come up with content, and I knew that if Donald Trump was the president of the United States, we would have 4 years of absolute gold.
It is gold, but it's so easy for like comedy and everything, because everybody shits on Trump, but I love it. And how about going into the lion's den of the UN, which he says does nothing.
The globalists.
We need to back out. They're worthless, which they are. I mean, you look at the blue hats. They don't do jack shit. They never do. It's always, oh, the UN's here. What are they going to do? They're going to pass out MREs and that's it. You know, I mean, what?
It's kind of a preposterous, you know, premise anyway, since we are such a big part of the budget. And we sit on the council that has absolute veto authority if we ever say no to anything just alone. This whole idea that it's like this Woodrow Wilson League of Nations, where it's a democracy of republics and it's this high-minded ideal, is ridiculous.
He called
a spade a spade.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a show.
Ultimately, the way we decide, and if we can convince the European Union and, you know, either China or Russia on any single stance, that's the way it's going to play out.
So let's get into the actual speech. Let's play. I found on YouTube a highlight reel. I watched the speech, and I didn't get a chance today to cut it up in the pieces that I wanted, but I feel like this kind of does a pretty decent job of capturing all the highlights. It's around 10 minutes, but we're going to play it throughout the episode, and we'll start and stop it and discuss certain points. But the next voice that you hear will be that of President Donald Trump.
God Emperor Trump, if you will.
Speaking to the United Nations yesterday, September 20th. Oops, sorry. I shouldn't be running my own board.
It is a profound honor to stand here in my home city as a representative of the American people to address the people of the world. As President of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first. But we can no longer be taken.
I think that was a really important point. It was the first time, like, when you had Barack Obama go and speak to the UN, it was the high-minded ideals of here's how great the UN, and here's our shared goals of peace, and the United States makes mistakes, and we're not perfect, we're just on equal footing with the rest of you. This wasn't Donald Trump saying, we're the greatest country in the world. This is Donald Trump saying, America First is just the common sense reality that I'm the president of the United States, not the world, and I'm going to make sure that I put America's interest first.
One of the things Barack Obama actually stumbled into the weeds with early on in his campaign, in his first go-around in 2008, was someone asked him if he believed in American exceptionalism in a Q&A session, and he said, I do. And he goes, and I believe in American exceptionalism just the way that Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism, or Syrians believe in Syrian exceptionalism. And really what Donald Trump's saying is no different. It's just framed in a different context and a little bit more of a provocative context.
But Obama was also an apologist, too.
Well, he thought that was the best way to moderate, you know, radical Islam. You know, if you would only unclench your fist, you know, that was sort of this what a lot of people criticized it as an apologetic tone. He really did believe in the worldview that if we weren't so if we weren't so ugly American, you know, in sort of the Bush style, you know, we're going to do it on our own, whether you like us or not.
But that fire had already been lit.
It had, you know, and that was a misread by him, because there is no amount of moderation and sort of a conciliatory tone towards radical jihad
and
that's going to make them be like, oh, well, maybe these guys aren't so bad.
And half the nation takes that as weakness.
Showing
your hand.
You know, it looks like Jimmy Carter toward the Iranians.
Yeah, we're backing off, you know.
Yeah, and so that's the really hard part. But I mean, it's really great that he went that route. Because a lot of the criticisms are he is the ugly American and he's George W. Bush on steroids.
Yeah, he's basically explaining the Make America Great Again strategy is that I'm going to put America in front of the best deal. And you really do get the sense with Barack Obama, like he today was in yesterday spoke in New York around the same time that President Trump was speaking at the United Nations. And he was speaking to his highfalutin, you know, liberal friends and some climate change summit, or I forget what it was, but it was some, you know, world poverty.
No, it was the Man-Bear-Pig summit.
Right. It was basically where a bunch of rich people get together and throw money at a problem and feel good about themselves and then pat themselves on the back, like a global initiative type thing.
It's like a Davos.
Right.
It's the Davos crowd.
And exactly. And he really wants to be important in that group. And he was important in that group, and he was beloved by that group. Whereas Trump is met with a lot more skepticism, fear. He's just, you know, He is the ugly American. I think that's a great way to put it.
And Donald Trump's whole career, and Dad knows this, you know, as well as I do, is Donald Trump wasn't ever accepted by any group he's ever been a part of.
Especially in New York. He was an outcast in New York. He always had been at any social, especially social clubs that he'd go to.
Exactly.
He writes about it in his books. And
he had to. He's like the classic Gordon Gekko. Like in the movie Wall Street, he talks about he had to buy his way in because he was a street guy. You know, he was a city college guy.
The only
guy.
Way they would give him credit was through him taking it and him taking their money.
Them
paying him.
You can either be brought in through lineage and pedigree and schools and, you know, the right connections, or you can buy your way in, but you're always viewed as sort of new money.
Well, he was always looked down upon because his dad was pretty much a slumlord. I mean, if you want to look at it that way.
And he went as far as
the old money went.
And he went to Fordham, which is, you know, which is a great school, but versus northeastern elitism, it's not a great school. And then transferred to Pennsylvania, where he was top in his class. But he just never, even when he rebuilt Manhattan and restored it to the playground of the rich, he still had to build his own social club in West Palm Beach in order to be a part of that society.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ted.
No, I mean, Greg's completely correct.
All right.
I mean,
well, let's get back to the speech. The next part, and I think that this kind of wraps in, it weaves all through this, is the Paris Climate Agreement, which was signed by Barack Obama, and Donald Trump has signaled, if not said, that he's not going to be a part of the climate agreement anymore.
Yeah. Advantage of, or enter into a one-sided deal where the United States gets nothing in return. No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea.
Obviously, we've slipped back into North Korea. I apologize I didn't set that up. But But yeah, I mean, I think the... And he touches on this later on, but he talks about how much the Americans have paid into the United Nations, that we're not... We just want what's right. We want our money to work.
Well, who doesn't? I mean, he's a financial man.
Mm-hmm.
You build a building, you expect people to work, and you spend your money wisely, and then you get return.
Yeah,
the government doesn't ever get return on investment. I mean, especially in his eyes. And foreign policy, you're never going to get back, especially when you're shipping boatloads of money overseas and then protecting other countries. I mean, what do you get in return?
And it's rare to see an executive from the private sector in the role of statesman and diplomat, because government doesn't consider itself like private enterprise. And so a CEO accepts the world as it is. Like these
right.
I can go and rail about, you know, all the corruption and the greed, or you could be like how Donald Trump handled things. And the reality is the mob controls the unions in New York City. I need to get things done on time. I'm going to hire a mob lawyer. Everyone else can just be damned.
Yep.
And so that's the way to get things done. And so for him to look at like a climate treaty from the perspective of, well, why are we doing this if we don't gain anything and it does nothing to actually affect climate change?
Whereas I think Barack Obama doesn't look at it like a capitalist. Barack Obama looks at it like this is a blessed nation, and it's our job to redistribute things to the poorer countries of the world.
It's two different schools of thought. It's one of them is if we do not do this, the world's going to end and we're going to be guilty of it. And the other school of thought is, okay, we're going to tax the shit out of our people and have to raise all these taxes. What are we getting? We're bringing carbon down what? 0.5%? Nothing?
Right.
And what does that do in the long run? And nobody else is doing the same thing as well. It's all financial, because financials hit home immediately. If you go taxing your people 20%, whatever it's going to be, you're immediately going to feel that. And the economy is going to feel that, and then you're going to have people moving out as far as business-wise. So that's where you get from the politician, because what politician wants to go up and say, okay, no, I don't like climate change, and we're not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're losing votes because all the scientists say climate change is real. But where in the hell does taxing someone, where does that actually come to make change
right.
in the climate? It doesn't. I mean, you're not doing anything. All you're doing is giving more money to the state.
The theory behind the entire carbon exchange is that you economically depress the sectors of the economies that produce more carbon emissions, and therefore you get less. You're using economics to fix the problem.
You're putting tariffs on businesses who produce.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
All taxes affect behavior. And
right.
so the idea is that you are going to use taxes rather than to create incentives to give a proper incentive for like things like Solyndra that failed, which virtually every positive incentive approach toward climate change and green energy has failed because the market isn't there, the technology isn't there, demand isn't there.
And the problem isn't big enough yet.
Exactly. And it hasn't been felt enough by the major players. You know, China has just said that they're going to be banning anything other than electric cars.
Mm.
The Politburo has the luxury of doing that. The United States has a parliamentary process, a democratic process. They don't have the benefit to do these things. And it's really funny to me, the inconsistency on liberals on climate change and enviro-Nazis, because all they talk about is Western imperialism.
Right.
Then when it comes to the environment, they are the champions of Western imperialism. The
right.
United States has to lead. We have to be the global leaders. We have to be the ones to set the example. And yet, in virtually every other element other than social justice and the environment, they are silent.
It's right. the most blowhard platform you could ever go on, too, because you're talking about a country of 300 million leading. If that's not the most elitist thing that you could do, is saying, listen, everybody's got to get behind us.
And
do what I say. Now, granted, China, everybody else, bigger populations, but how much carbon can we be shitting out? I understand that we've got cars and everything else, but...
Yeah, but it's inevitable as an economy develops, especially in the BRIC countries. They're not going to say, oh, well, it's bad for the globe, so we're not going to rely upon it to grow.
But right. as well, how much tax are you expecting to get back in off 300 million people, especially if you tax all the business out of it? What are you going to get? I mean, tax is a negative incentive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, now is actually a really relevant time and a beneficial time for those who talk about these types of schemes. Because if you look at Puerto Rico, if you look at countries that stand the most to lose by rising sea levels, places where if the environment or if these types of events happen with more frequency, it does. Like right now, Puerto Rico's power grid is shut
it's
off.
There's 3.4 million people. The entire life.
Yeah.
And so this would be an example of when, okay, we would keep, theoretically, we'd keep all of this tax revenue in sort of some sort of escrow fund, and then in the event of an emergency, it would be deployed.
Right.
Which really isn't that bad of an idea.
It never happens.
That's the thing, though. It's the practical reality is that that gets spent on something else. That gets spent on, like, wind farms in New Guinea.
It already is
lockbox.
It already is spent.
And it's because there is no such thing as bureaucratic efficiency.
No, that's especially that's financial efficiency.
Yeah.
There's none.
There just isn't any way to we, mankind, controls its fate to an extent, except for natural disasters.
Right.
And no matter how great geoengineering becomes, and if you believe Alex Jones and the what was it, the Doppler?
He's the only one I listen to.
HARP. So, like, yeah, like, so ideally, if Alex Jones were correct, that would be the solution to geoengineer these types of, to prevent these types of catastrophes, not a tax and, you know, a progressive welfare tax system.
Right. Well, it's the broken island syndrome. You tear down the entire island of Puerto Rico.
You just Henry Hazleted the broken window fallacy. Yeah.
All right, let's jump back into the speech.
It's great for the economy.
The broken Rican syndrome.
Yeah.
Listen,
every year, every 2 years, we're going to just send them.
Aria, this is not an excuse not to pay your bills, okay? All right, here we go.
Why not?
The camera just flashed, FYI.
We're all good. Looks good.
Can I flash the camera?
Yeah, go ahead.
No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. It is far past...
Oh, I love it.
And unfortunately, this recap it skips around a little too much, so we'll come back to North Korea, but let's address the Rocket Man...
I love
specifically.
It. He does brand people really well.
He's the master of branding, and I love how he, to me, it's a shit on the Never Trumpers, the not my president, because
right.
It's absolutely no respect. Not that, I mean, Kim Jong Il should have any, but it's just hilarious to me. I love it.
I guess.
And you know he was so giddy when he was saying that. He was sitting there before that, and he was like, I'm saying that.
It just seems so out of place because it was...
It is, but it's what we're talking about. This is the master of branding part.
Right.
That's all you've heard about for the last, what, 2 days, 3 days? When was the speech? Yesterday?
Yesterday.
Yeah, so you're going to be hearing about it for a month.
I guess I just don't understand the whole point of the Rocket Man phrase, because it seemed weird.
Well, he had tweeted that out a couple weeks ago, I think.
I know, but this is like a really important presidential address, and it's him laying out his big vision, and then he does that, you know? It just doesn't really make sense.
How did you feel about it?
The whole speech as a whole? Or
no, just that.
Just that.
The petty Rocket Man comment.
I felt it was petty and beneath the presidency, and it's not that it's like I really give a shit about the presidency per se. It's that it makes things harder, and China basically came out afterwards and said, you know, you're just making our job harder, and you have to tone it down. And the thing about diplomacy is that, yeah, you need to be a provocateur sometimes, but in some ways, like the Rocket Man comment and making himself look like a Hugo Chavez or a Kim Jong-un with that kind of language, it puts him on the same level as a Kim Jong-un when we really need the leader of the coalition trying to avoid a world war to have more class than that.
He knows what he's doing. I mean, let's be honest. He's been doing this for how long? And he's been pushing so many buttons. He gets all the intelligence updates. He knows through intelligence that Kim Jong-il does not like that. And I guarantee you he put that out. He said that because he knows it. And it got a draw and rise out of him. And obviously you see what Kim Jong-il says.
Personally, like, personally, to me, I see both sides. In diplomacy, obviously, it's never
it's
good
horrible.
To yeah. create a petty grudge, because it just really, it actually does prevent, you know, to be rich, free, and alive is the price you pay is,
right.
you know, what we go through, you know, the United States, and to be the leader of the free world. And so with Kim Jong, to call him Rocket Man, it doesn't bother me at all personally, because also I think a lot of people are really nervous. And I think a lot of people are very much sure we're going to war over North Korea, where there is nothing to gain and absolutely no reason to.
Right.
And so I think it does a great job of marginalizing him in the eyes of people who are nervous, because it makes him seem like, you know, the Acme Air Force with the Acme bomb.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't even recognize North Korea as an independent state, correct?
No, that's not true. I mean, Jimmy Carter made a visit to North Korea in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of all downhill from there.
Well, they caught one of our subs spying on him, and that provoked the entire situation.
Right. So Jimmy Carter, like I said, in the 70s when he was president, and then obviously when Reagan became president, it was much more of a hard line. And then, you know, once Kim Il-sung in the late 80s started to, you know, it was the 80s when they started to pursue nuclear weapons.
Yeah, they built the military.
And that's really when things started to go south. I mean, North Korea was fairly peaceful after the Korean War up until the 80s.
It was a philosophical experiment at that point.
Exactly right. And if I'm reading this book called Nothing to Envy, which I cannot recommend enough. I mean, it's such a great book. Just watched a couple documentaries. One was Dennis Rodman's Big Bang at Pyongyang, which was hilarious.
I've known people who went with Dennis Rodman on
really
a basketball trip. Yeah, yeah.
Honestly,
to play basketball.
This sounds so ridiculous, yeah. And you guys are going to laugh so hard. But honestly, thank God for him.
Yeah, no. If you watch that documentary, you realize this guy deserves a Nobel Peace Prize far more than Barack Obama ever did.
Obama got it on his first day.
And talk about someone who comes across as very inarticulate and, you know, comical.
Yes.
But thank God they do have some type of dialogue, and it's over non-political things. It's over, you know, very much it's over hobbies. And
well,
it's
he's
over
Western
him.
Educated.
Yeah. And I mean, and you don't have to be a diplomat. You know, that Dennis Rodman, though, it is very good that he has ties directly to the leader of a rogue nation that is a nuclear power that's developing the ballistic missile technology in order to hit the United States West Coast. And if you don't have that someone in that capacity, you're dead in the water. Because then you're going through third parties to open up a dialogue.
Yeah.
We could literally send the worm in. I know it sounds crazy, but we can send the worm in.
Well, he was on The Apprentice. Do you not see how North Korea meddled in the election?
Yeah, exactly.
What you see in this documentary is that here is an American with a group of American basketball players going and interacting with the North Korean basketball team, and that is broadcast all over the nation, and it is Americans who are very large and could be threatening, hugging and high-fiving North Koreans, and it just takes some of the propaganda, the wind out of the sails with the propaganda. It's like in this book, Nothing to Envy, where they're talking about the propaganda around the Americans. Basically, the Americans are the Jews to the North Koreans, Nazis. And when this one of the characters in the story, it's not a fiction book, it's you know, non-fiction narrative. She basically was talking to her mother, who in the 50s saw American soldiers, and she said, well, yeah, the Americans were very tall and very handsome. We used to chase after them when we were little girls. And the daughter goes, you chased after them? They didn't chase after you and attack you? She goes, no, they were all very friendly. They gave us chocolate bars. You know, and it's that, and that was an eroding moment for her, where she started to realize, oh, maybe there's propaganda being fed to me. And that's where Dennis Rodman is a very effective person. I mean, he embarrasses himself pretty heavily.
He likes to get drunk.
He went off the wagon on one of these trips.
Yeah, he gets super shit-faced.
But if you watch the documentary Aim High in Creation, which, let me tell you, I was very conflicted by this documentary, because I hated every Australian in the documentary, because they're all just complete socialists and tryhards.
You know Australians are shit posters, right?
Right. Well, this is not that. This is just this wacky liberal woman trying to
that's what I'm talking about.
Make her own little propaganda film against fracking in her neighborhood. And so she goes to learn the movie techniques of the North Korean propagandist ministers. And you really end up liking the North Koreans a lot in that. They seem very sincere. They seem very sweet. They keep saying, you know, please don't come back and invade us. Like,
it's way better than the Australians. That's right. All I can say. Australians are shit.
The war was,
they're upside down, man.
They very, very clearly do not want war. But it is a really interesting look in these two documentaries at, wow, they're human beings just like me. They're avatars.
Once you get into the human side of it, it's completely different.
Leaders are what's wrong with the world.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, if we brought you know, the most hardline Iranian, you know, voter here and just had a conversation with him with absolute no threat whatsoever, just to try to open up a dialogue, we would all walk away friends or at least have a better understanding of each other.
As long as Kat wasn't here, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Kat hates the Muzzies.
Well, she'd try to be their friend, and they'd be like, ugh, strange American girls. Yeah,
was that her who was chanting, muzzle the Muzzies, when I was walking in?
It's time for a Greek Holocaust.
Jesus. I said, just eat some yogurt.
Well, no, but I mean, that's the thing, is it's leaders. It isn't, the leaders try to, you know, they're the ones that are responsible for the divides. These divides end up becoming pissing matches. Years of grudges build up. Yep. You know, people compete for resources, and then it reaches a crisis point or an inflection point where you either are able to pin it on somebody else and reach an agreement where you can blame, you know, you both sides can save face, or you end up going to war.
Let's be honest, anymore, the North Korean situation is just the trying to hold on to the power is what it is.
Right.
Because if you watch any of the documentaries, I've watched the PBS documentaries, I've known people personally who've gone to North Korea, like I said, on the basketball trips with Dennis Rodman.
Greatest rebounder in NBA history.
The Worm, baby. I mean, he. When you watch it and you break it down, they understand it's propaganda, but it's getting to the point where they are just doing what they're told so they don't
die.
Family die. That's the thing. The threat of death is not only to you, it's to everyone in your family and everyone down the line, anyone you're related to. That's how fucked up it is in North Korea.
If you want to understand, I guess the best way, in all the different things that I've been reading and all the different things that I've been watching, trying to understand North Korean society, there's, again, this book is called Nothing to Envy. And there's also another book out there called The Cleanest Race, which talks about the propaganda of race in North Korea. That's really, really good.
Talk about some racists?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Well, it's
Chris Cantwell doesn't hold a candle to North Koreans.
Well, so in the –
Free Chris.
In the Japanese before World War II, for about 40 years, occupied – this nation and tried to strip them of all Korean identity and make them essentially the civil rights era before that in the 30s, how Black Americans had zero rights but still were expected to go and fight in world wars.
Oh, the Japanese are the most racist people on the planet. Right.
Indian. So the Japanese considered themselves like Indian Brahmins.
Right.
And it was a caste society. And so then the North Koreans, through the Imperial Japanese, you know, philosophy and worldview, they were the essentially feudal serfs. They were at the very bottom, the untouchables. But as citizens, they were still expected to go and die for country.
Absolutely. And there was a tremendous amount of propaganda trying to strip them. And before that, the Koreans were a very proud, historic people. And Kim Il-sung and his effort to make them realize that they are the greatest country on the planet, and they are the greatest race on the country, and that everybody else are dogs, that was a natural pendulum swinging back the other way. And it is an important part of their identity to understand. I mean, it is a very moral people. It is uncommon. So one woman in 74, she said, you know, in the 70s, I was a 24-year-old school teacher. And I didn't know – that's when I learned how children were born, how children were made at 24. Two of the characters in this book are young lovers, and it was 3 years before they even brushed arms or held hands. It was 6 years before they kissed. Like, premarital sex is just not done there.
I mean, it was an iron fist, and I mean –
Well, it, so then they defect to South Korea, where there's sex clubs everywhere, and it's very sexually open, and they're just disgusted by it. I mean, it's so it is a very conservative people.
It's how I feel about left libertarians.
Right.
What?
I'm just completely. I'm completely disgusted by their moral corruption.
I just want to correct something.
And the
you
rest
said.
Of the commune loving gypsies and their free love.
You did say that North Korea was the greatest country on earth, but we all know.
I didn't say that.
Yes,
that,
we did. No, that's what they say. But we but we all know to be true today that Kazakhstan is the greatest country on the earth.
Well, exactly. I saw that in that documentary with
Borat. Yeah,
which is a hilarious movie.
It's a great documentary.
Nothing does a better job of exposing the most fringe elements of the hardcore Christian right than seeing Representative Pickering from Mississippi speak in tongues at that tent revival.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that shows you the kind of voting block that is thinking, actually, the world's going to end on Saturday if you are one of those types.
That's why I'm drinking now, boys.
Yeah. This may be our last podcast. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, thank Jesus.
And September 23rd, according to a Christian numerologist and astronomy researcher from an unnamed university in Kentucky, which is where all the great astronomy research is done, has predicted that September 23rd will be the final day.
Unfortunately, I will be sick on Saturday. I already can tell.
I will be getting blasted down at Lake Monroe camping. Probably dropping acid, looking at the stars, and I'll be like, take me, Jesus.
I just want to go lay in a field and watch, you know, the flowers play a symphony, man.
Yeah, you know how it is.
There is another book.
Left libertarian.
There's another book that I would recommend called Under the Care of Fatherly Leader that is a very detailed explanation of the rise of the Kim family, essentially.
This is something, you know, I'm very interested in. Is like, I'm not opposed to the creation of sort of an internal propaganda technique to create a libertarian movement.
Right.
You know, like,
if
I'm
it's
really
used
not.
For good, then well, what, I, who's it hurt?
Well, no. Like, that's the thing. Is now, granted, get it in the wrong hands, it turns into an absolute nightmare. However,
right.
Luckily, I have a dear leader I can trust.
That's exactly right.
And so long as he has a male child to pass the lineage on, then we should be good. We should have a dynasty of mandatory libertarianism.
It's by Bradley Martin, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. It is also a great book. But yeah, and then they get into chapter 9 and 10, the 90s in North Korea under the... Basically, this was when the Great Famine happened. I mean, You're talking about a country this around the size of Pennsylvania with 20 million people in it. And the government says somewhere in the tens of thousands died, but they think that it was somewhere between 2 and 3 million.
It was millions, yeah.
Actually perished because of famine and starvation.
It's like a CBO report.
Exactly right. And it was one of the most moving, sad narratives I've ever read in a nonfiction book. But it was one of the most eye-opening because you just see the effects of bad government policy when it combines with sanctions. And people just start starving to death and dying, and it's terrible.
Every totalitarian regime that is founded and premised upon communism, sort of this end state or trial run of what Karl Marx never actually articulated. You know, he didn't actually end up presenting a perfect idea of how it would work.
No, it's perfect on paper, and that's
but
what,
no one's ever like. That's
there's never
is,
a human element,
and Marx never provided a structure.
No,
so Marx, you know, much of communism, much people don't, what they don't realize is Marx makes a very compelling case for like the material development or the what is it? Oh God. Historical materialism and the way things develop and the way you move from feudalism to capitalism to socialism to the end state and eventually the state withers away. And the thing is, though, Marx specifically never laid out what it looks like because he had no idea and he didn't want people to be locked into it like a religion.
Yeah, there's no way to predict the future either.
Right.
And he knew it would take time. And
he really presented what he thought might be two ways. One way would be through very heavy socialism, very favorable worker policies, labor policies. The other through a vanguard party, which ended up being the Soviet Union, where it was a vanguard party where it was very much mandatory communism, but it's only in it for a temporary period. You have to suffer through the pain.
Yeah, we'll
and
get
the slaughter,
through this.
And then
as soon as we defeat
be...
our enemy, they start pointing out enemies, and then you know we got to go get this resource or whatever.
And you need to suffer, and you're suffering for the greater good, and yada yada yada.
And you could have all the resources on the planet, but you're still not going to, as long as you start your population keeps increasing and nobody's doing anything, you're not, there's no purpose.
And you can't centrally plan a dynamic economy. And so that's why they all end up trying to be closed off. Because once they're closed off, they think they can control it. And that's why every single time, whether it's Russia or the Soviet Union, whether it is North Korea, whether it's North Vietnam, any communist social experiment to try and create what Marx talked about ends up in famine, because mankind can never anticipate all of the factors involved.
And there's no point in trying. Who's going to keep farming when there's nothing in it?
It's a fundamental misread on what humans aren't entirely self-interested. Like, you know,
humans are the most complex animals on the planet. Well, that's why we're here.
We're empathetic.
That's why we've evolved this level.
Yeah, it's not like Adam Smith where Adam Smith said everybody's out for himself. It's not raw, rugged individualism, because humans recognize there are times where it actually is beneficial to be a part of the bigger self.
It's not perfect on either side. It's a yin and the yang.
We've demonstrated times where we say, you know what, it's actually better. Rather than me pursuing what I would say is my best interest, the outcome is so unlikely that I would be, get all of it. I'm going to go ahead and assimilate in and work for the greater good as a whole. Because that's been in my better. That's a more likely self-interested outcome.
Yeah, and it could be easy. It could be less stressful. Less stress on you personally.
Exactly.
And
your
family.
And so that's what you see in these experiments, and why they almost always exist and they end in famine. And like, you even go back to the Soviet Russia after the Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall speech by Reagan.
Right.
We would have people come here to learn, because the Soviet Union, as it was privatizing, they had these planning committees to plan how to feed their country.
Absolutely.
And they couldn't figure out how to do it.
They'd only teach so many people and then a certain way.
But so then they came here, and one of the most famous things that ever happened after the Cold War was they go to Houston, they go to a supermarket, and I can't remember if it was Yeltsin who was with Reagan or who it was. In
was
the
that
Houston,
the pineapples or something?
Well, yeah, and he goes, how do you figure out how to feed a country of 200 XYZ million with no planning commission? And then he said, that's the beauty of capitalism. We don't even try.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
people get what they want.
Right. And, you know, that's what Reagan understood. And that's what, you know, he was it's funny, much of Trump's rhetoric in this speech reminded me of Reagan. Ryan Connor actually brought that to my attention earlier today. And it's funny, Reagan handled it with humor, though, because he would always tell this joke about the Soviet Union during their, while they were, right on the precipice of a famine and didn't want to lose face before the world, is that the premier of Russia goes out to the agricultural czar, takes him on a tour, and he goes, well, how is it looking this year for potato production? He goes, well, I'll tell you, it's going to be amazing. Mother Russia's going to have potatoes that'll reach all the way up to the heavens. And the premier says, I hope you remember, this is the Soviet Union. You know, we've banned and outlawed churches. And he goes, well, thank God, because we're not going to have any potatoes either. And so, the point is that you can't plan for such a changing dynamic society, because price and human interest and self-preservation all sort of culminate into a way that actually distributes, resources and
naturally
feeding an economy.
Yeah. Go ahead. The thing also that we were talking about is how when the famine hits and when we will put sanctions on a communist country or whatever, like we did, it's hilarious how it's an economic, we won't ship, we'll cut, we're not going to trade with you. And then all of a sudden it's famine. So it's the economic thing that kills them.
Well, it's always famine. Always famine.
That never affects even the top food chain. It's always
it's
always the innocent, the workers who get screwed.
To be fair, Kim Jong Il was eating potato soup every
great
day.
Great leader.
Every day during the 90s famine, he was not living on the high
that's
on the
bullshit.
Hog.
He's not his son, though. Like, that's the thing is
yeah. Well, what I'm saying is,
he was in Switzerland. Kim Jong Il was.
Kim Jong Il, but then his little fat son plumps out here. You know, it's like, okay, you weren't eating potato soup. But that's the point.
Yeah, with his Rosie O'Donnell haircut. What the fuck you been doing?
Right, and in this book, during the famine, the well-connected, you have these black markets. So it just is amazing how, even in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, you had North Korea was fairly prosperous, But in the basement of apartment complexes, you would have like a storage bin, and that's where people would keep their kimchi pots.
Kimchi is
fermented cabbage. This is going to be a minute. So kimchi.
I'm going to take a piss. All right,
I'm about to screech.
It's gonna smell like kimchi.
So kimchi is fermented cabbage, and it's a delicious treat. I love it. And they would put their pots down in the basement, and they would padlock it because people would come and steal the kimchi. And it was just like, okay, if you are a communist country and food is free, why would there be theft of food? It doesn't make any sense.
I don't understand. Communism is supposed to perfectly from each according to their ability to each
exactly
according to their
right.
Need.
And during the 90s, nobody owns their property, nobody owns their apartment. But you rent an apartment, you are granted the rights to live in an apartment by the government in North Korea. There is a massive black market of rent, selling, and trading because people shift and move up and down, and so they trade their rights, and then they bribe bureaucrats to look the other way to transfer those rights. So why it's the our libertarian friends on the left who think that property rights shouldn't exist, mutualism is the way to go. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Like, in a communist country, your rent is murder is silly. Like,
yeah.
You have people trading away their apartments to get the money to buy food. And the well-connected families all have plenty of food and get out of more trouble because they've bribed off more bureaucrats. So,
it's funny how Ancapistan kind of becomes itself inside right. of a communist dictatorship.
Any type of communal society or communal ideal community architecture for shaping or forming a society, one, it would have to be organic, something like a commune or a kibbutz, where it's tribal, where it's very much, that tribe trusts each other and they look out for each other.
Right.
The second you introduce foreign or you're less familiar with people, it collapses because it becomes an us versus them, limited pie worldview.
Right.
And so the fundamental assumption that humanity is a blank slate, that the human is born blank with no pre-program or predisposition to self-interest, is the fundamental flaw of communism.
Right.
And that is why it fails every single time. It doesn't scale. It can work in a small organic syndicate or a small commune. It can work. It just doesn't scale out because all of a sudden you don't know the person that you're working 40 hours out in the fields for.
Especially when you're born into a communist dictatorship. I mean, how?
And they have programmed these people.
Absolutely.
Spangle knows this better than anything. The founder of of North Korea,
the Methodist
Kim
Church?
Jong-sung, yeah. John Wesley.
Kim Il-sung.
Sung was an idealist.
Right.
This was a philosophical experiment to see if the perfect society could be built.
Yes.
But in order to do so, he needed to do a couple things. He needed to give pride to a group of downtrodden people mm-hmm. who had been told they were dogs.
Right.
So he gave them pride, and he gave them a creation myth. He gave them something to be proud of by appealing to any type of movement. The best thing you can do is to give them something to unite around and get over the petty squabbles that do exist and working towards a common cause is to give them, like in America, it's the founding fathers. It's our, the Declaration of Independence and how that's never been done before. And we're the last great shining city on a hill. In North Korea, it's a restoration that they're this special race. Then you reinforce it with your rhetoric. You constantly repeat and repeat and repeat and allude to pride and constantly try to touch on tones that make them remember and feel emotions that they're not downtrodden anymore and that they're in control of their fate.
In North Korea, if you see any North Korean, you'll see a pin on their chest, like we have flag pins, and it's every person has to wear a pin of Kim Il-sung. Mm-hmm. There's a statue of Kim Il-sung in every location. Every school has to build like a Kim Il-sung center. He is literally their god.
No, he is. He is God.
Juche.
Yeah.
God physically on earth.
He created his own philosophy called Juche. You have to have three paintings now in your house. You have all three of the Kims that have ruled. and you must clean your painting, and there is a monthly inspection by the local block monitor who comes in to make sure that your painting is clean and tidy.
How do you get that job? I want that job.
And it's also a surveillance job.
It is.
Oh, absolutely.
It's exactly. I mean, they have, you know, the levels of surveillance and different surveillance teams is absolutely maddening.
It's like McCarthyism, what they tried to do with the Red Scare, where you turn neighbor on neighbor in America.
When I read it, it really feels like 1984, or if you've seen Man in the High Castle, like that is a very real, that is North Korea. Like that is how it works there.
And that's the pen is the third most important. That's the third leg of how to create these types of environments,
right.
Symbolism. Because it's way easier to spark meaning and reinforce meaning and constantly reaffirm the message you're trying to get to brainwash into them.
Right.
With symbols rather than words. Because if you can create the environment
where
everything they see reminds them of the pride, and they can never escape what you're trying to get them to learn by imprinting that on those symbols,
yeah,
it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that they end up never being able to leave. And that's why the threat of outside intervention or any type of access to outside information, conflicting information, it completely collapses.
They don't even have like words for like butterfly or dragonfly, not because they don't exist. They don't have it. Like,
right.
And what's going to liberate North Korea is going to be either we're going to go to war, or it's going to be technology, because it's already on the technology path. That's
right.
The thumb drive. I don't know if you've watched any of the documentaries about the thumb drives they pass. They'll send like balloons across the borders and shit. With thumb drives are rapidly turning. I think I watched a documentary from 2013 or something. It's a couple years old, but defectors are talking about it, about thumb drives from China and from South Korea, just with radio shows and TV shows and news, just entertainment more than anything.
Right.
That is getting over and getting into the hands of the North Koreans.
It's like what we did in Vietnam, North Vietnam, with pamphlets and flyers.
And it's the young children. Campaign. It's the young children. It's not the old people, because I mean, maybe it is.
They bought in and they have too much.
The
to
young
lose.
Children. Absolutely, they're already gone. I mean, their brains are mush at this point. They've lived through it through three dictatorships. But the information is what's going to liberate the people, and it's going to be an upright. It's going to have to be.
Any country is going to have to liberate itself.
Absolutely.
That's why I don't believe that sanctions and that war will liberate people, because what happens is when we go to war. So let's take Korea, because it's a very real example of our intervention messing up a situation. You have Kim Il-sung is part of the Chinese fighters who are taking on Japan, who owns the Korean Peninsula. Then World War II happens, and Kim Il-sung, and they manage to start to take it over after the Japanese lose.
Yeah.
The Russians start moving tanks.
After we cooked them.
Right. After the Russian tanks start moving.
After the little boy.
Into North Korea in 1945. I mean, there was no North Korea yet.
Yeah. It was still Korea.
Right. And then the Americans panic, and so they start working with the Russians to create this entire concept of North and South Korea. Okay, Stalin, you get the north half, we get the south half.
Yeah, they just went in and broke it up one day. They said, we're drawing a line.
It's exactly right. We wanted Pyongyang, so Dean Rusk, who was one of two army officers who created Korea, North Korea and South Korea, drew it at the 38th parallel. It was a completely arbitrary line that they drew, and then they all agreed to it. Dean Rusk eventually became the Secretary of State during Vietnam. And then you have the reason that the Korean War eventually happens is that Kim Il-sung is put in place in North Korea. We have
there's a proxy standoff.
Right. For the communists, we have a weak president in South Korea. Kim Il-sung starts invading South Korea, gets all the way to the end of the peninsula except for one town, and then they send MacArthur over and drive them back, and the Russians and the Chi-Coms started fighting the Americans, and it was a proxy war for 3 years.
It was a philosophical battle. The Cold War was a battle of whether state socialism and in-state communism was going to defeat Western liberalism.
It was also to have a a player in the game in that side of the world.
An example.
Yeah.
But the communist, like the Berlin Wall came down because of blue jeans. It came down because
it was going to fall eventually.
Russians
but, yeah.
wanted blue jeans, and they saw what Americans had, and they wanted it. And so, and then the same with the Chinese. You can argue that the greatest weapon for freedom was Nixon flying into China in 72 and opening the door to Chinese commerce.
He did more for changing the tide of the Cold War than he will ever be credited for because of how he behaved in the White House.
Absolutely.
Money flowing into the hands of the common people will always change anybody's mind.
If it weren't for Richard Nixon's brilliance, and he was absolutely brilliant. You know, he was paranoid, so he's kind of like a John Nash beautiful mind that kind of lost it and went down the rabbit hole. But his brilliance and foresight to understand that the future of the next 200 years of America were going to be an Asian pivot and not a European pivot, and that China, if handled correctly, would become no longer communist. It may be communist in name, right. But the truth is
they're Americanized as fuck.
They have heavy-handed economic capitalism.
Yep.
You know, they very much can dictate and decide at, you know, on the go. And that's what you see with the electric car decision, that they're only going to sell those because they understand that they're actually hurting themselves, and they make social unrest more likely because of the smog and the environment they live in. And so that's a strategic decision to maintain power. Because as the environment cleans up, it's more likely the Politburo stays in power. And so with North Korea, though, it isn't easy. Like that's why Dennis Rodman, I swear to God, is so important, because he is the lone piece of corrosive information in Western culture that is allowed in that country. And it's hard to overstate the importance of that.
You could argue he's the only personal relationship.
He's more powerful than any threat made by any president. And with China cutting off all of loans they're servicing, and Taiwan cutting off the natural gas, any of these sanctions are way less effective in
because
actually changing things.
That doesn't affect
Rodman.
The dear leader.
Well,
to
but,
be honest
but here's the thing: what it does is it undermines the propaganda, and it humanizes Americans. It makes them curious. So
absolutely,
and curiosity is what kills dictatorships.
So, as Greg referenced, the Chinese central bank today came out and said that they are no longer going to allow their banks to trade with North Korean banks.
So they fund them in basically subsidy loans they never collect on, that never get paid, to keep them propped up. And so this is a huge thing.
Right.
Huge. And then Taiwan, who sells them the natural gas to keep the few lights on they have, if you've ever seen satellite photos.
Yeah, if we can get them to get the power off.
The thing is, will Russia step in and fill the gap? Because both the Chinese and the Russians have repeatedly stated they aren't going to pursue sanctions that hurt the populace.
Mm-hmm.
They're fine with hurting the regime. They're absolutely fine with cracking down on lending to the people at the top. The infant mortality rate, the mortality rate for children is so sky high and ridiculous, it's honestly pretty humane, because it's also, they understand that eventually, even if you depose Kim Jong-un, someone has to lead.
Exactly right.
And so they understand they need people who haven't been so morally and physically beat up that you just get a replacement totalitarian dictatorship.
And China doesn't want, there's no way China wants a neighbor literally on their border for the Kim Jong-il to go down, and then you've got, how many people? What's their population?
It's four million
people, right? Something like that.
North Korea?
I don't know.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. You're talking about, I think it's 5-6 million
people.
Hold on,
I know the answer. Communists, James Neese told me this, since communists aren't moral agents, they aren't considered people, so it's a population of zero.
Okay, so technically you don't have anybody. But you're talking about, I mean, what are you, 5-6 million people? 5-6 million uneducated people who are living in pretty much the 30s.
But that's not true. It is educated.
Unskilled worker. They're going to be unskilled, though. They're not going to want to take them on.
No. It's a country. I mean, it is people with a lot of skill. It is, like, you see that in the propaganda movie. These are very skilled movie makers, very skilled storytellers.
They're the best propagandists in modern history.
What they did is they took Goebbels.
I'm talking about the average person, though.
But so here's the thing. During the USSR era and during the Chinese Communist era, North Korea was a very for a communist country, it wasn't prosperous, but people were comfortable. And then in the 80s, as both of those countries started to transition and collapse, and then in the 90s when they cut off North Korea completely, all of their natural resources that they didn't have started to flow in out, like it was cut off. And that's what caused the famine. It caused an economic death spiral because they didn't have anything for anybody to do at that point. Their labor force actually went negative at that point, like because entire factories were closed down. And so you'd look at the smokestacks. One of the characters in this book, Nothing to Envy, talks about the smokestacks were a great predictor of whether they were going to eat in the next couple months. Because if one smokestack out of the 10 was firing, that meant, well, okay, somebody's working, somebody's making money.
It's like the Federal Reserve uses rail shipping rates in the United States to predict economic growth. It's,
yeah.
It's a target or a signal.
Exactly. And so you do have skilled people. You have, especially in technology, it isn't as backward as I think we think it is. I think that is part of our perception.
But mentally they are.
They're very much a country stuck in the 50s, and that you're
that's,
right.
That's what and I'm talking about. I'm talking on the mental level.
And
I'm
it's
not
a caste
about-
system. It's a caste system, like you're saying.
Absolutely.
It's two societies. It's the hardcore, you know, the mainliners that will just hold the communist line every single time. They're given the opportunity to move up and become an asset to the
and
party.
It's 25 million people.
Yeah,
20,
okay, so 20, you're talking 25. 25. Yeah, yeah, you're talking five times what I just said. And the thing is, the lower class isn't going to adjust as far as the upper class. And it's a pyramid. It's not...
So what, we should just not do anything?
No, or? I'm saying that the best way to do it is... China doesn't want it, is what I'm saying. As far as a population-wise.
Right.
As far as going with China. I'm saying the best way to do it is gradually through technology is the way I would see it done. Because you're not going to be able to do anything... militarily, because Seoul, South Korea will be knocked off the face of the planet if you do it that way.
Yeah, what you don't want is a refugee crisis flooding into China and South Korea, and that
which is what you'll get if you go in
right.
quick.
And I don't agree that you can have sanctions that will you're going the sanctions of the 90s still hurt people. I mean, it hurts the lowest common denominator. It starts with children, and that's where infant mortality rates go up.
Yes.
And then it goes to old people, and that's where hunger starts to eat at the older generations. And then it floods down into the 60s, 50s, the 40s, and then it starts to affect people who are physically fit because they don't have body fat to burn. And then the first people that die off out of each one of these groups are the people who are good people. They don't want to steal. They don't want to participate in the black market. They don't want to be dishonest.
It turns everybody into,
right.
you know.
There's a lot of Holocaust survivors who didn't want to keep touch with anybody they knew in the camps because they all had done something that they were ashamed of that they didn't want to remember.
Yeah, I mean, it's the plan goes down. We gotta eat whoever dies first.
Right.
I mean, it's that mentality.
Libertarians are gonna hate me, but the answer is Egypt, because we've propped up a technocratic military dictator because we didn't want the Muslim Brotherhood to take over and win and create Sharia law, and there was no natural heir or a competing person that would build sort of a Turkey-style secular Islamic democracy that might take hold and flourish. So what we did is we backed Assisi up, who was educated at the United States War College, and then said, you need to run, you know, make sure the Muslim Brotherhood knows that if they show their face, it's going to get an iron fist. But outside of that, you just run a technocracy. You make sure that all of the utilities are on, make sure that people can feed, make sure the currency's stable. We'll help you with that. But beyond anything explicitly laid out in what we're going to allow you to do, don't go on any excursions. And that's what he's done and why he's maintained power and why Christians aren't being slaughtered in Egypt, whereas they are in Syria and Iraq.
Well, but part of that problem is we're a decade away from that.
Right.
Like,
there's no Assisi in North Korea because there's no contact.
And you're not – there's – who are you going to – you're going to have to give a guy $1 billion and prop him up CIA style if you're going to do that in North Korea.
And that just
creates
resistance.
If you want to keep it a state.
But here's the thing. That doesn't exist in North Korea.
I know. That's what it's...
Because what you realistically have, it's so different than any other... It's not comparable to anything because you have a country that... It's not like where... who was the guy in Egypt who was in America who was like... went to Princeton and was like a favorite, went back and became president for a brief time until the Muslim Brotherhood took him out.
Oh, Morsi?
Morsi. Yeah, you don't have one of those guys.
A Karzai in Afghanistan.
Exactly right. You don't have you have some exiles and maybe they're not high profile, but you have a lot of people defecting, but you don't have you have a country that since 1945 has had a complete control of every aspect of everybody's life, and from what everybody can tell from the outside, although you have defectors that come out and talk about how horrible it is and how much they hate it, you don't seem to have anyone. You don't have dissident groups in North Korea.
There's no one that has stood up and ever been identified as an opposition or a martyr.
You know what? Just thinking about
like
this?
In Iran, it was the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Right.
And so until there's someone that is identified, that rises up organically, has traction.
Who will have the backing of the people.
Then is a political exile that we take huge precautions to make sure they survive. And then provide them with the right resources in a transition of power, if they could even maintain it and keep the allegiance of the military.
I've got a plan right here. Jackie Chan is world famous, and you back him by the Yakuza.
So here's what
that's Japanese mob, and Jackie Chan is Chinese?
I believe so. Why not?
IUPUI, why not both? I know.
It's slant on slant crime.
Okay. So here's where I just don't even... So I think that part of the fear over North Korea is the ghost of communist pasts. it is an evil regime because it is an evil regime in that it is a totalitarian regime, but it...
In a damn good one.
Yeah, you don't have... like
they're so isolated, it's great.
You did have in the 90s, basically entire regions, Kim Jong-il just cut off, you know, he just stopped sending food to those regions. And so you did have genocide taking place, regional genocide.
In Israel, they call that infatada against the Palestinians.
Right. Oh, something. So you have...
Rosh Hashanah.
But... by and large, it's the people that live in that country that are responsible for taking control of their own destiny, and it is our job to try and economically trade with those people. But to me, the pursuit of nuclear weapons is one from everything that they say, and from everything that it's not like Iran having nuclear weapons, where they have ties to Islamic terrorist groups around the world. North Korea just wants to be left alone, it seems like.
Yeah, they want to keep this experiment going.
Exactly right. So it, to me, the threat of North Korea having and keeping nuclear weapons is not something that scares me. It's not something that worries me in terms of an issue of world peace. That's why I've never understood the concern over North Korea. The panic seems to be that they're communists, and it's the baby boomers who are just freaking out about this. It's not our job to change the regime.
You're absolutely right. It's not, but the nuclear weapon side brings an entirely different point to it, especially if you're going to look at it as a geopolitical with Seoul, South Korea. Like, South Korea. Because the regime has stated time and time again that South Korea is theirs and they're going to wipe it off the face of the planet.
Right.
The only reason that we are getting news about North Korea is because they have threatened us.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on for how fucking long?
It's because they're in a famine. Their worst famine since the 90s.
It's right. Japan, they need it's aid. South Korea, it's anyone in the region. So if you want to talk about, it's not a direct threat to you. I agree with that. But as far as a geopolitical, it completely is a threat if they get the weapons that can do that. And they already have the weapons they want. The thing is, they can destroy Seoul right now if they want to.
Sure.
They can wipe it off the face of the planet without nuclear weapons.
But they don't.
They won't.
Sort of the point. They're not going to make that move.
There's no reason to take South Korea other than Seoul. It is mountains and unlivable.
Right. It is
75% of the population lives in Seoul.
Right.
It is a leverage game is what they are playing, and it has been for so long. That's how they get what they want. They'll threaten whatever, and then they'll get whatever in return.
Desperation is driving this.
Absolutely.
So they only have one thing to do when they get desperate.
It's
because so starvation causes social unrest. Social unrest drives the need for them to get aid. The only way they know how to get aid is to act like a rabid dog.
Right.
When they act like a rabid dog, they're used to concessions and foreign aid.
Because they agree
to stall the development of their nuclear program. They can feed their people. Social unrest quiets down. Status quo remains the same.
Right.
Right now, this famine is so severe, and these economic sanctions are going to hit them very, very hard. because now you've cut off their natural resources through natural gas from Taiwan, then the 25 to 8 million roughly market cap size of the loans being serviced by Chinese that are no longer going to be allowed, and are because China stands to lose too much. They're just sick to death of this.
Yeah.
Russia is the only one that is going to prop this up. We're right back to the Cold War.
And it's not even
And it annoys us, so they're going to continue to do it through the black market.
It's not even what I don't even believe it's what they do or what we do back. It's who responds. It's not just a two-player game or a three-player game. It's everyone in the region, and especially when you have...
It's about the petrodollar is what's going on.
And then you have that on top of it, absolutely.
That's what's driving all this. With Venezuela no longer
that's
trading...
That's the same thing that's going on in the Middle East. So right. if you don't want to believe that Syria and North Korea are connected, they are.
Their regimes decided to stop trading in the U.S. dollar for oil. Every regime that stops trading in U.S. dollars, which is now Russia, China, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia will in time. Libya. And if Saudi Arabia changes, well, everyone that's threatened it, Iraq in 2003 and Libya under Gaddafi,
when they
stopped doing it, we overthrew those regimes. This is all about the petrodollar because the United States entire... We're not gold-backed.
We're faith-backed, and we're faith-backed and by
since,
the petrodollar.
And so since Saudi Arabia controls OPEC, and OPEC decides they're going to trade in dollars, that dominates the majority of the world energy market. That means that it drives up the value of the U.S. dollar because everyone has to acquire U.S. dollars in order to buy oil and conduct trade, which means that the United States can essentially print unlimited dollars and finance all of their deficits. The second that is no longer the case and arises a rival to the U.S. dollar to conduct trade in the energy market, all of a sudden the United States' ability to just continually print money will no longer be met with unlimited demand for U.S. dollars, which makes a debt crisis much more likely. Which is what this is about on a bigger scale, because now Russia has a vested interest since they're no longer conducting trade in the U.S. dollar.
Mm-hmm.
China's no longer doing it and doesn't have to. China's
bought all of Africa as well.
Right. And China's trying to recreate the Silk Road, and they'll just charge a toll every time you want to trade in their areas.
Right.
You know, and that'll guarantee you safe passage like a mob. You know, it's security.
So this isn't...
And so, but for Russia, propping them up guarantees that there is still a rabid dog on their leash they can control to annoy us and make sure that a war doesn't get started.
Mm-hmm.
They can't go to war with us. The Chinese have no interest in going to war with the United States.
Right.
But if they can annoy the shit out of us with the little hermit kingdom that threatens to spout off about his interballistic rocket man and his suicide mission with missiles, it is in their best interest to do so. Because Pakistan sold all... They're the ones who've given all the nuclear technology to the North Koreans. And you know they're smart because the Iranians haven't been able to do shit. Mm-hmm. And the North Koreans have been able to develop weapons that are very close to being able to hit our shores.
Yeah.
You know, so the North Koreans aren't dumb people.
Well, they've picked the best and their brightest, and then they've sent them to highly technical schools. I mean,
Russians have the best engineers, and that's where North Koreans are educated.
Yeah, make no mistake, these are not dumb people. These are not crazy people. Like, this is a complex society that has...
the ones running thing.
Not all of them. I mean, there. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of poor people, but it is not as...
They're not aborigines with 85 IQs.
Right,
the aborigines
are
smart.
They're untapped resources, yeah. But no, but I mean, like, the aborigines, when they tested their IQs, were at, like, 55 and hadn't discovered the wheel.
Yeah, right.
These people are raw untapped
potential.
Gorillas
are, like, 65.
But, I mean, this is raw untapped potential on a massive scale.
Yeah.
They're Asians. They're smart as fuck. Come on, let's be honest. They're just brainwashed.
Yeah. All right, let's...
Where are we in? We 3 minutes into this video?
We literally got 90... We got not even 90 seconds
but
in.
But I think this is really important to understand because no one's talking about this.
Yeah.
No one is talking about why there's no strategic interest
for
the United States to overthrow that regime.
It's 5D chess. I mean... It is. I mean, it literally is. When it comes to North Korea, and
I would be stunned if anyone in the State Department or the United States, if anyone in the people that are in his cabinet think about it on this kind of scale, because Steve Bannon is the only one with the
intelligence.
There's
no glory in overthrowing North Korea.
But Bannon was the only one with this worldview, and he's gone. Stephen Miller is smart, but he's not smart on foreign policy. Like, right now it is all neoconservatives, and this is domino theory all over again.
Yeah, this speech was written by Stephen Miller, and he's the last remaining of the nationalists in the
And he's a domestic policy specialist, right. You know. And so, honestly, I think Rocket Man came from Stephen Miller because he was the one who did that interview with Jim Acosta where he goes, "Listen, Jim, your cosmopolitan worldview," which cosmopolitan is code for urbanite Jewish person queer during the Holocaust. So that's why he used that specifically, and he's an alt-right hero. He's one that went co-chaired the Duke Conservative Union with Richard Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's his speechwriter, and that is him, 100%, being the Jimmy Rustler 4chan poll, you know, guy that he is.
All right, let's. I'm switching over to a different video, so you're going to hear some stuff that you heard previously. But that last one was a hot mess, and. I want to play you something that's a little more high quality. So we're going to let this roll, and then we will come back and then discuss and stop as we feel we need to.
As President of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first. As long as I hold this office, I will defend America's interests above all else. In America, we do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example for everyone to watch. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. We will stop radical Islamic terrorism because we cannot allow it to tear up our nation and indeed to tear up the entire world. We cannot let a murderous regime continue these destabilizing activities while building dangerous missiles, and we cannot abide by an agreement if it provides cover for the eventual construction of a nuclear program.
He's talking about
Iran. We seek an approach to refugee resettlement that is designed to help these horribly treated people and which enables their eventual return to their home countries to be part of the rebuilding process. For the cost of resettling one refugee in the United States, we can assist more than 10 in their home region. Out of the goodness of our hearts, we offer financial assistance to hosting countries in the region. And we support recent agreements of the G20 nations that will seek to host refugees as close to their home countries as possible. This is the safe, responsible, and humanitarian approach. The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions.
I think that point about helping refugees outside of the United States, that's one of those parts where if you watch this whole 45-minute speech, I think you and you should, and I'll put it up on the – we have a feed called Raw Audio Politics out there in iTunes that you can get, and a lot of times I'll go and post speeches that I want to listen to on my RSS catcher, speeches like this, and I'll put this speech in there. So if you want to listen to it all on podcast, then you can grab that. And I'll also put the Rand Paul talking to Congress – the other day that we played in last episode, bits and pieces of that, I'll put that whole speech in there. And you really get a sense in this speech that this is him articulating his worldview and putting more information and policy points into ideas like, no, we're not going to let refugees in. Okay, well, what's your plan? And he's never really had a plan until now. Now he's saying, hey, it makes more sense if we can help 10 people instead of one outside of our country by keeping them near their own.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a very good, easy-to-understand way of talking about why why the answer isn't just unlimited immigration into right. a country, and why it's very important to give them hope in forming an organic governing system that they can be proud of and will take, you know, will take footing and will have a lasting impact.
If I'm not wrong, correct me, but I believe he wants to fix the problem with the refugees from the country they're coming from rather than, all right, we'll just bring everybody in right. to, you know, Europe or America or whatever. I understand you're a refugee. Okay. That's not the problem. The problem is what's going on in the homeland where you have to run from it.
The question is whether it's salvageable.
That is correct, especially now, like Turkey and everything else. It so depends on what religion you are, what sect you are, especially if you're in Syria or if you're in Iraq. I mean, I'm not saying we're innocent and all that shit, because obviously we've fucked up the Middle East.
It depends on who gave you the money to get there. Because if you were given the money by a mosque with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, it's very likely that you are going to be called upon to do a favor at some point.
And that was always the smoking gun. Not smoking gun, but it was always the if you're playing Mario Kart, it's always the upside down fucking question mark that you're going to hit. All right, which one of these is going to be the suicide bomber? You know, because we're going to let in some bad apples or whatever it is. But
it's the uncertainty principle.
One bad Skittle, Tyler.
It is
James
the one,
Weeks.
It is the one bad Skittle. I mean, as shitty of an analogy that is, it is, because it's worse than one bad Skittle. I mean, you're talking about an entire religion, and the religion lets you lie if you are.
Well,
but, go to heaven.
But here's the thing. Like, all the bad Skittles here, like San Bernardino and Boston, these are homegrown terrorists. These are not people that are bad Skittles that were Syrian refugees, for instance.
You're absolutely right. But
they self-radicalize.
Right.
I'm not even talking about on the American scale of this.
Yeah, it's European.
I'm talking more on the European, where you can walk across the board. We're talking thousands.
We're talking like in Sweden, where from 1996 to today, where you've seen like a 10,000% increase in rape and crime.
There is a stat, too, that once...
Somebody's doing the raping.
That was my point.
Somebody's doing... Have you seen the Swedish flag that's the cock?
No.
And it's going into it. You know, it's the greatest meme
ever.
Well,
Dustin Reed turned that into Chairman Sarwak today.
Did he?
Yeah. I showed it to you guys.
Oh, that's right. I was like, don't post that. I don't need this.
And you mistakenly thought it was anti-Semitic. It's anti-Swedic.
No. He was trying to make it anti-Semitic. Yeah.
No, I was...
We are not going to be associated with anti-Semitism.
I may have been drinking at the time. I said, well, it's Rosh Hashanah or whatever it is right now.
Yom Hai, Yom Shamash.
Yes, Yom Kippur. Happy Yom Kippur.
Anyway, my thing is, it's okay to take in refugees for, obviously, Puerto Rico. We're going to need refugees from Puerto Rico. As far as
they're not refugees, they're citizens. So.
No, they're refugees.
Protectorates.
Come on now. They're parallel Mexicans. We all know that.
And actually, I blame much of what's happening with their current catastrophe on Aria Torres not liking God Emperor Trump.
Honestly, yeah. It's her fault.
I tried to warn her. She did nothing.
If Joe Ruiz hadn't left the podcast, this would have never happened to Puerto Rico.
He got skinny and Puerto Rico got pretty soggy. I'm not going to lie.
He sent a photo. Are you saying they sent a photo of him down to Puerto Rico
and
women flooded the place?
He's like, they all said, we're trying to get fat. And he's like, oh, I just lost 350 pounds.
Well, this is why, I mean, we've had the city-state in the grand scheme of history is a very recent development. And we've had free-flowing people moving from economic opportunity to economic opportunity over the whole
but
of history.
You're not talking about economic refugees here. You're talking about political,
but
more
it's
than
all,
likely.
But isn't it really all kind of the same thing? I mean,
no,
people
not at
flow.
All. Not when you bring religion into it.
No, but people flow from tyranny towards freedom.
We're not talking about Buddhists coming into this nation.
But Buddhists do come into this nation.
Absolutely. And how many of those... Let's go back in their nation.
You are surrounded in this area by Chin.
I know.
Chin Christians. Hold on. Chin Christians who are fleeing the Buddhists.
Absolutely.
Who are murdering their people.
Absolutely.
The Buddhists do the raping. Let's right. be clear, clear. Confucius say...
The Buddhists.
Absolutely, but they're not doing the raping here.
Yeah.
I mean, the Rohingya Muslims are being slaughtered by Buddhists right now.
I know it's not popular
religion of peace.
Right.
I know it's not popular to say that it is Islam that is a problem.
It's leaders. It's leaders. It is leaders.
Exactly.
It is intellectual, philosophical, and governmental leaders who
make these people leave.
Who hold power.
And then they put people in with the people who leave. Right. I mean, it's not. It's not hand in hand. The Islam is.
But they give purpose to people looking for it. That's what usually happens.
Islam can be peaceful.
It isn't. It's very rare that it's a jihadi John who leaves a Western lifestyle of finance to go and become a beheader for the ISIS.
Right.
It's much more often the guy that can't even feed his family and is looking for something.
Out.
Yeah, he's desperate. Yeah. He's socially isolated. He wants to get married. He sees that it gives him a sense of purpose that he's never found, and also financial opportunity. And so it is very much how you look at it. And that's why it matters how they got here, where the money came
absolutely.
From.
Absolutely. My best friend's dad came here from Lebanon when they were in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Hashem?
Yeah.
Send him back.
Well,
Vlade Divac needs to go back.
Come on. Because he cucked you?
Jihad.
Because he cucked you?
No.
That's sexual jihad. That's completely fine.
No, because literally every woman at the last party was like, get this guy away from me.
It's
because
they feared the beard.
The human animal inside them went, danger.
He said, I will make you my goat.
I guess I don't understand your point because...
we shouldn't go down the rabbit hole on immigration. We just really shouldn't.
We're talking about that next week, actually, with Lil Brett.
And there's no answer.
There isn't. We've talked about this multiple times.
Open borders are the answer, Tyler.
Open borders to where? Canada? Yeah. No.
We have an open border with Canada.
To Israel. Basically. Israel, yes. Yeah. If we want to open
when
the borders...
When they dismantle the Iron Dome and they grant the right of return back to the Palestinians that they basically... excommunicated from where they had already been settled, then I will give any credence to libertarian proclamations by virtue signaling libertarians.
When they return their stolen
land, until said thing
happens,
next week is going to be great.
Every time I hear how the Libertarian Party supports open borders, I just want to talk about how they starve the Palestinians and call it retribution. And yet all I hear is dead silence from the chairman when it comes to that. Just like this.
All right, let's finish up the speech.
As close to their home countries as possible. This is the safe, responsible, and humanitarian approach. The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States. And I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me. The Venezuelan people are starving, and their country is collapsing. Their democratic institutions are being destroyed. This situation is completely unacceptable, and we cannot stand by and watch. As a responsible neighbor and friend, we and all others have a goal. That goal is to help them regain their freedom, recover their country, and restore their democracy. We are prepared to take further action if the government of Venezuela persists on its path to impose authoritarian rule on the Venezuelan people.
Sorry about that. I turned our mics off so we could swear off air. I guess I don't understand, I get the existential threat argument in North Korea and Iran because they have shown that they do pose an existential threat to the United States. So
not to us so much as Israel,
but to us. I mean, if you look at the stated goals of the terrorist groups that are supported by Iran, they definitely do have ill will towards the United States
for us and, for our support of Israel.
Right. It is our choices in our interventions in other places that lead them to have those. If we just didn't meddle in foreign affairs, then we wouldn't be the target of these two countries. But here's what...
Correct.
I don't get the Venezuelan thing because they pose absolutely no threat to us.
No, it was that was apples and pears in the same quote there, I think. I don't know what the hell he was talking about.
That's a nod to Brazil. is what's going on. Okay. Is Brazil's entire governing structure has been found so corrupt they can't even find judges to try the people on charge for the leaders of like Gazprom.
So basically, have you seen Narcos?
Exactly.
Basically, like Colombia,
and that's so, where we held so the
that's,
Olympics.
That's yeah. in South America. You know, given that's where like the motorcycle diaries for Che Guevara. That's you know where he rode through the countryside, and where the United States first tried out neoconservatism through like land grants and propping up dictators to combat socialism. They're very much more open and amenable to socialist ideals. Venezuela is something you don't want Brazil to catch. You don't want them to become a nationalist socialist country. I hate to say that, but you very much don't want that, because then what everyone has hoped would take economic freedom, free markets, gas, you know, global financial integration will collapse into a tribal communal mindset that will end up exactly like Venezuela,
which is a tough much away from in Brazil,
and they're already much more susceptible to that anyway, and so is Mexico.
But if you're a Brazilian leader, don't you want to wouldn't you want to push that?
There aren't any Brazilian leaders right now that have any. There is not a single Brazilian leader that holds elected office at this moment or in a government position that people haven't just gone ahead and assumed are corrupt.
Right.
Because pending every investigation.
For the last 12 years.
I mean, you're finding people on the. It'd be like finding out that John Roberts was getting a monthly stipend from Vladimir Putin.
Right.
That's the kind of institutional decay you're seeing. And this, everyone's great hope was that Brazil was going to be the economic miracle. The Olympics would be their coming out party. It'd be the arrival of the BRICS on a grand scale. You know, that's where all the money was flowing for investment, you know, because it was seen as a better deal than the United States, more room for growth. And you're watching it just shrivel. You're watching Russia shrivel.
Right. It's pretty much just little Incapistan. I mean, it's just...
I mean, what it is, though, is you're hoping that's not a contagion that catches, because Argentina's a perpetual mess. They declared bankruptcy like, you know, people that live on Kentucky Avenue in Indiana.
I declare bankruptcy!
Yeah, they're like the Michael Scotts of South America.
From what I get from the speech, I saw the South and Central American, the nods to that, more as an economical
and this point is, it, again, than, the petrodollar.
Than the Iranian point. But there is the Venezuelan thing's tied, because you're talking about oil.
They were trendsetters in saying we will not trade.
They were the number one producer in the fucking world for like, what, 5 years?
If they ever got their act together, they would be Saudi Arabia of South America.
They would be.
You wouldn't even need Brazil, but... You know, Nelson Rockefeller, the whole reason we even have neoconservatism is Rockefeller's oil field was nationalized in Venezuela. Their top producing one.
Yeah, because they want to keep the people happy.
Right. And so then
the savages.
The nationalist government, the nationalist government said, no, we're not going to renegotiate those leases. You're going to pay triple. And then we did what we did in Iran and propped up somebody. There was no Pinochet to come and save Venezuela.
Not enough helicopters in the desert when I'm here. Too much sand getting in the motors.
I'm sorry, I've stopped listening because I need to play this.
Did you mute me?
Hey, cuz.
This is Argentina.
Heard you're having money problems.
No, you didn't.
Listen, I got the answer. You declare bankruptcy, all your problems go away. Creed Bratton has never declared bankruptcy. When Creed Bratton gets in trouble, he transfers his debt to William Charles Schneider.
How does that help, Creed? In Monopoly, you go bankrupt, you lose.
You don't go by Monopoly, man. That game is nuts. Nobody just picks up get-out-of-jail-free cards. Those things cost thousands.
That is a good point.
Bankruptcy, Michael, is nature's do-over. It's a fresh start. It's a clean slate.
Like the witness protection program.
Exactly. Not at all.
I've always wanted to be in the witness protection program. Fresh start. No debts, no baggage. I've already got my name picked out. Lord Rupert Everton. I'm a shipping merchant who raises fancy dogs. That's the life. I declare bankruptcy!
That's where Cristiana Fernandez, the president of Argentina, got the idea. She watched The Office, and she speaks English, and so she just started going around to world economic events and yelling, I declare bankruptcy.
And Bernie Sanders had a giant boner.
All right, let's finish up the Trump speech, and then we'll start wrapping up.
Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell. But the powerful people in this room, under the guidance and auspices of the United Nations, can solve many of these vicious and complex problems. God bless you. God bless the nations of the world. And God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
So it really is, it's not him saying we're getting out of the United Nations, we're not pulling out. It was him saying, hey, we pay 28% and you guys need to start pulling your weight and we're unhappy about these things and we're not going to carry all the burden on all these different issues.
We're about to start listening to complaints in the exact amount you contribute toward the budget.
Yeah, right. I mean.
So EU, you get 30 seconds.
Right.
The floor is yours.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking, oh, Switzerland, yeah, we don't give a fuck. You're not paying shit, all right? Right. And
our chocolate's better.
It is. And,
that's great.
And they have guns. Something you left out, I don't know, you definitely can press that speech, because there was a point where he completely shit on socialism. Did I miss that?
Or
did you cut it out?
No, it was a cut that somebody else made. Okay. So I didn't have time to cut it down, but you're right.
If you guys go and listen to it, he completely shit on Venezuela. I found it hilarious.
There was a part where he outlined his entire philosophy on a bunch of different things, and I really do think that it's a speech worth listening to understand Trump's foreign policy and really a lot about his internal policy. He eloquently explained his immigration ideals in it.
Yes.
In the first, like, 15 minutes.
People immigrate for opportunity or to escape.
Right.
And if they would much prefer have a stable environment to live in their homeland.
Exactly right.
And he did an excellent job of doing that without sounding like a dick.
And yeah. I think today we get immigration and refugees confused so bad. And then if you're coming to this country for a better opportunity is pretty subjective depending on where you come from and your background and what you want to do here. But I mean, a Syrian refugee is not the same as an Asian.
You want people coming to pursue opportunity.
Absolutely.
Because they believe it, that it's, you know, Craig Ferguson wrote in his book, I think it was called I Am America. Or,
That's I Am
American. That's Stephen Colbert,
can, yeah.
And so can no. you. But no, his book, Craig Ferguson's book, talks about, you know, I'm Scottish by birth, but American on purpose,
right.
by choice. That's exactly the kind of mindset you want in American. We are a nation of immigrants, and you want people who come here because we're representative of the dream of justice that mankind's had for all time.
Yeah, and
you want people to come and build a better life.
And you want, you know, people with grit.
Right.
Who fought, who had to escape shit.
Who you have to worry about are people who get a subsidy to flee.
The problem is,
that's the real question. And it's not that it's a political refugee or someone fleeing China because they went and marched in Tiananmen Square. It's someone who is sponsored by a family that has ties or has connections to ISNA.
Right.
I hate to say that, but that's the truth.
I see the problem just as bad as people who are already here who despise America.
And
it's not even the people who just immigrate here. It's
the United States is 20 years behind Europe as far as what the white identity being activated. You're seeing
white identity.
We've always been white ethnocentric, always in the United States, because
right.
we've been the predominant voting bloc. Whites have.
Right.
Yeah, we've been but, 70%. Yeah.
Right. And then the French started watching, you know, one of the pains in the asses of colonialism was all of a sudden immigration.
Right.
And they started watching the Browning of France in places in Marseille where the French police didn't even have control. And it was
all the Moroccans
courts.
Came in.
Right. And so then you saw this, well, maybe colonialism was a bad idea.
Right.
It wasn't like the Indians where they, you know, they assimilated very well and they aspired to be British.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much different where they do not assimilate and would rather just live within your system and not be subject to your laws.
Right.
It's the
in the United States, the white identity will be activated by political Islam. The more political Islam becomes prevalent, and the more that the immigrant or not immigrants, we will always love and celebrate immigrants. I guarantee it. It's just
right.
it's this creation myth we love to tell ourselves, but we will always be suspicious of political refugees coming from regions that make us nervous and who don't immediately come in and start, you know, singing the Star Spangled Banner. They decide to stay in Dearborn and form their own communities.
I would add nuance to what you said. We celebrate our immigration heritage. We don't like people who are starting their own.
Right. We don't celebrate ours and pander to ours.
It's right. coming. It's coming across the border and trying to turn, I don't know, let's say Phoenix, Arizona, into Mexico City.
Right.
It's we're not going to speak English. We're not going to do that. And this isn't to pick on Mexicans or whatever. I'm saying that they're the problem. To me, it's more of a religious thing. Obviously,
it's just an assimilation thing. It's whether they participate in the communities where people feel comfortable and they shake hands and know everybody.
Right.
And the more exclusive you are, the more you feel, because that's the thing too. Immigrants, and if you look at the demographics in the United States, outside of white people, if you look at polling numbers, every other ethnic community and ethnic demographic trust institutions in the United States less and less.
Right.
And so the less you trust institutions, the less you turn to them for solution.
Which is
And the less you participate in the democratic processes, and the more naturally suspicious people are of you. And that's just the end result. And so what we're watching is what already happened in Europe is the activation of the white identity, because for the first time in the history of the United States, it feels threatened.
Right.
You know, in my opinion.
Tad, you feel threatened?
No, I don't feel threatened. You want to know why?
Why?
Because I have a Jew last name, I'm tan as fuck, and every time I get pulled over, I smile and I say, I'm sorry, officer, I didn't realize my plate's been expired for a year and a half, which just happened 2 days ago.
Listen, it's great being white. I got pulled over doing felonious speeds about 2 months ago, and then nothing happened.
I don't know. I don't understand. America's a good place to live in.
But that's what I mean, is it is, if you're white.
Right. It's great.
I'm not. Look at me. I'm tan as fuck.
All right. Let's start wrapping up. Final thoughts for this episode. Tad Western.
Oh, shit. I love you guys. Why don't we go out and sing karaoke more often?
We should.
I don't care.
I blame Jeff Vibbert.
Vibbert, honestly, since he moved.
He did. He got too big for us.
Yeah, he got too famous for us. And now he's too good for us.
Shout out to Barstool Sports. They're doing a Purdue homecoming this Saturday.
Like, they need our help.
They do. They
Barstool.
Do you realize how many views we get? I mean, you get. Not me. Oh. I get thousands.
We'll never have the turkey audience you
have. Yeah. Tad Talks.
Listen, I'm huge in turkey because I'm quad. What comes after quad?
Quintuple?
Yep, quintuple.
How do you say quintuple language?
You're a polyglot.
That's
what you can speak multiple languages.
Quali-guap.
Polyglot.
Apparently, I speak a lot.
Bullshit. I speak a lot of languages.
I was raised on bullshit.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, I love seeing you guys, and I wish I could come on wall more often, be more of a help. I didn't realize tonight was going to be a North Korea night.
We didn't either. We had a lot. We were going to talk about the Mueller's investigation. We were going to talk about more, you know, how the hurricane risk.
Can we talk about crazy Maxine Waters? Did you see what she did? Dick Gregory's
impeachment
eulogy?
Will be whatever we want.
Did you see her Dick Gregory's eulogy? Look that up tonight. You will love it because Dick Gregory was a comic, so you will love it. But anyway,
go make sure you go out and buy a copy of Dick Gregory's book for all of your friends.
Yes. It's called...
Nope.
It's called Here's
Some
Dick.
Let them be surprised.
I don't even know. Oh, it starts with the N-word, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, anyway, I want to thank you for having me on. I know last time we were on, we kind of got into we butt heads a little bit.
Did we?
No,
I think
not with Kat.
Oh, I was really fucked up. I don't know.
No, not with Kat.
Maybe emotionally we butted heads. But listen, people, tadwestern.com, go there. I've got my own emojis for everybody. You click, and it randomly gives you an emoji, and that's who you're going to be for the rest of your life. Number two, listen
to Tad
Talk.
There was somebody that tried this system once.
What?
Just was more numeric than emoji-driven.
Right.
Oh, was that Uncle Adolf? Are you talking Uncle
Is
Adolf?
Is everything Hitler with you, Greg?
No, it isn't. I just thought it was a funny... I don't like the idea of just being assigned some generic thing from an automated system.
Right. Listen.
It never works out well for the recipient. Right.
He was more famous than Jesus Christ, let's be honest.
All right.
Viewed in the right framework...
But he didn't kill as many people as that Chinese dude.
Mao? No.
Not Mao.
Pol Pot?
No, not Stalin. Genghis.
Genghis Khan.
Yeah. Yeah, come on. Let's know.
He didn't fuck as many people either.
He slanged as much dick as he did sword.
Honestly, in the history of dick slinging, there's no one that rivals Genghis Khan since, 67% of humanity has...
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, can trace their lineage.
I'm just trying to swing that sack is all I'm trying. That's devil's, you know.
Truth be told, the cuckold category on Pornhub should be called the con.
Yeah.
All right, Greg, final thoughts?
Wait a minute, I wasn't done.
All right, wrap it up. Come on.
Listen, I'm tired. I'm Tad Western. I appreciate everybody. What are you talking about? It's 9 o'clock.
I have been going since 6 a.m., sir.
Listen, I love your haircut.
Thank you.
Did you get it cut?
No, I had personal training before this. So,
oh, okay. You
nice
are looking
sweaty.
Awful slim. I'm not going to lie.
Thank you.
I'm down 5 pounds.
You look great.
I went vegan.
That is one sexy dad bod. That's a tad bod.
Well, when you get trapped in Utah against our boulder,
it's either lettuce or Mormon cock, and I chose the lettuce.
Aaron ate his arm off.
I know. Anyway, I'm Tad Western. If you don't listen to my shit, please.
All right.
Actually, shout out to Cedar Creek Winery,
Greg.
The big thing in the news is the Republican final last effort for a health care reform.
Oh, like that's going to pass.
I think it actually will. I think the desperation is going to, because it's the Graham Cassidy proposal. So it's Lindsey Grahamnesty, and then
super.
I forget. Is it Bill Cassidy from Louisiana?
Yes.
Yeah. It is their repeal bill, which really doesn't. It's not an enormous achievement, but I support it because it actually does something to an extent in that it repeals the individual and the employer mandates. And it turns the federal funding for Medicaid expansion into subsidies where the states decide. And it does a really excellent job of taking the top-down approach and delegating almost all the responsibility and putting it onto the states. The only thing is it does lack some of the it weakens some of the pre-existing conditions protections. And then it also, though, repeals all funding for Planned Parenthood. So I... As a libertarian, it isn't ideal, but it is what is achievable, and I'm very much I'm the type that if it is the last chance, because they only have 17 more days to use reconciliation and only need 51 votes, do it. When the opportunity is there, and if it isn't going to be there again, and you're going
to
face a midterm election where it may not be there,
you have
repeal government to the extent that it can be repealed.
Your scumbag Republicanness is showing.
No, it's I think it's libertarian.
Well, it's not ideal in any sort.
No,
it's not libertarian in the slightest.
No,
well, it wasn't to begin
all.
With. So,
but that isn't on the table,
right? The reconciliation runs out at the end of the fiscal year, at the end, the last day of September. It is the last day that it is easy to do it. You'd have to redo reconciliation and the budget rules and all that stuff. So it's still possible that you could get something different through.
If they vote by next week, they should do it. Now, that means the Congressional Budget Office probably isn't going to be able to put out a report, you know, telling how many people may or may not lose insurance. But I think that's already sort of known.
Who the fuck cares? They're paid by the government.
Who gives a shit what the CBO says? They're always wrong.
Let me ask you a question. Where does Rand Paul stay on this?
He's against it.
Absolutely. Where the fuck were you at like 5 years ago, Rand? No, we're gonna stay on it. No,
he had a plan at that time.
I know he did, but nobody votes. Yeah. Nobody votes for it. But how you've got to vote? You've got to take away from the state as much as you can. I'm with Greg on this.
I like it because
especially
it's a federalist
to,
approach. That's my primary thing. I enjoy it. It gets rid of mandates. It gets rid of mandates and it federalizes the approach.
I read
which,
this,
to me, are more important than anything else you could do right now because there's nothing else on the table that is achievable.
It's better than what we have now.
And nothing will happen if they don't do it.
Exactly, and it gets rid of the individual mandate. I mean, that's...
And it retroactively takes care of the penalties you would pay as an individual for not having it back to 2016, which I'm all for because that isn't... Not buying health insurance doesn't make you a criminal. You shouldn't be treated that way.
100%.
Speak for yourself, criminal.
Yeah. Right, and then let's see.
Well, I thought you were writing walls of text to like some girl or something. This is like walls of text to yourself.
No,
well, I had a week where I didn't have much time to prepare, you know, and so I did my best before the show.
Okay,
and so I sent it to myself as a message. But the other big thing in the news was the Facebook decided to hand over the information about the Russian political spending ads. And then the last thing was a ruling about Stingray laws. So Stingray is the technology that the police are using without warrants to spy on people. We're basically audio surveillance.
Right.
And through cell phone towers.
Yeah. They set up a... Can I be Harry for a minute?
Yes.
Yeah. It's basically Seymour Hersh.
They sit up...
Spying on the mail and the family jewels back
to
the CIA.
They set up a tower and then your phone goes through their tower... that they set up and anything that comes through it.
Because it's third party, that you know, that third party principle, they can...
It's technically not AT&T and it's technically not you, so it's not them spying on you.
You've
or
turned
AT&T.
Over your information.
That's some bullshit.
Well, the Supreme
because
Court...
Because you're in the vicinity of whatever right. the circle oh,
let,
is.
Let Greg go.
The court, ruled, the court ruled that you have to now have a warrant, which you never did.
Good.
So it's
that's
a huge
good.
Win for privacy. That's
the Supreme Court?
No, I don't believe it was the Supreme Court, but I could be wrong on
like
that.
Like a court of appeals or whatever?
Right.
It'll go to the Supreme Court.
And then the very last thing was Trump's been very controversial in his judicial selections because he's picked such partisans.
Right.
There's this old rule called the blue slip process where if the judge comes from a state of whatever senator, like say you're a senator from that state,
mm-hmm.
and you disagree, like let's say you're a hardcore liberal from Minnesota, but he wants to pick a justice that's a conservative from Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
With this blue slip process in the Senate, you can stop it because it's designed to be an idea to moderate judicial selections.
For the personal
selections. It's very likely that that is going to be reformed in that blue slip, basically the ability in a secret society or a country club membership, the ability to blackball somebody,
right.
you know. That is what this will eliminate. So they'll no longer be able to crush somebody.
That's good.
But it could also lead to very, very partisan picks, which can work both ways
right.
when not in power.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all about the power pick.
And the Dallas Independent School Board said that the founding fathers had Confederate ties. And so they will no longer, they no longer want
sure.
to name schools after them.
It's true.
No more Thomas Jefferson Elementaries or George
good.
Washington Elementaries.
There were racists.
Based on the Confederacy that didn't exist.
There were racists.
Barack Obama. We can make a school out of Barack, though. It's fine.
Whatever. Well, not the Hussein, just Barack Obama. Or really, Barry Satoru.
We're not getting, yeah. Do you realize he's a Russian agent?
Yes.
Did we get it? We didn't even get into any of the Russian Paul Manafort shit, did we?
We need to do that next week.
Can we do that on Tuesday?
Important. We need to do an update.
Yep.
Can we do that on Tuesday?
Sure. Sure.
Well, let's Harry what Harry's going to do.
It's my show. Tell Harry what we do.
I feel like Harry's a little, you know.
I rule with an iron fist.
He's gotten uppity.
Harry understands. Harry's actually been a great help to me, and Harry has been on the ball and...
Tuesday show's been outstanding.
I love it.
This last one was really good. So the numbers have the numbers. It we're not hitting 9,000 every episode, but I think that's because we've got two shows hitting the feed, and it's not taking a week to build. But from anecdotally, everybody's saying that they like it. So hopefully, people aren't fleeing us because we're putting out too much content. But people will adjust.
Can I ask you a question?
We've got two. We literally this week. I could do another 3-4 hours easily, just based around the Mueller stuff and some of the other stuff that we just
we really do
there.
Need to
that,
do an investigation.
That's an entire episode on itself, and that's what I thought we were talking about tonight, and that's what I studied.
I did
up
too,
on.
But
I'm
all right.
Sorry,
so you have me next.
No, I think
week.
That no, the UN thing was my call, and I think it was good because
the North Korea thing
North
was
Korea,
awesome as well.
North Korea is what people are going to really hear a lot about, and they need to understand
the
intricacies of it.
And we also, I think it's very. I will say this, and you know, scumbag Republicanism intensifies. But I think the president's last two speeches in Warsaw, I thought was very good, defending the principles and ideals of Western civilization, and not you know apologizing for individualism, was very strong, and it spoke to me. And then I also think this was his most coherent policy speech. And as
yeah.
well as Donald Trump can articulate a coherent framework for a belief system, he did.
That's what this was. That's why I think it's an important speech of his.
And it was nuanced in a way he's never done.
I think John Kelly pick has really turned his presidency around, and I think you're going to see a lot more effectiveness.
Well, John Kelly cut out the bullshit.
Yes.
And to me, I'm a person, I don't give a shit what you say. It comes down to what you do and the policy, to be honest with you.
And I think the Rocket Man, one thing I forgot to mention, the Rocket Man comment was designed to keep the press talking about
absolutely.
That and not about the Graham Cassidy bill.
It's
coverage for them to get this done in private.
The North Korean
thing. Because no one's talking about Graham
Cassidy.
It's
smoke and mirrors. Just as I believe that the entire North Korean narrative at this point is smoke and mirrors to keep it away from Syria, keep it away from what's going on in the Middle East. I truly believe that because you don't hear shit about it's you've got to keep nobody has any focus anymore. Let's put it that way.
But no,
it just says you wandered through the minefield of drunk Uncle Tad.
Listen, let me tell you about the Mexicans.
Well, whenever he does something that seems to make absolutely no sense whatsoever, but
ends up dominating
the media,
right.
There's always something competing going on in the background that needs to avoid scrutiny.
It's like when Paul Manafort's house got raided. He tweeted out the LGBT. It was the exact day.
Really? Okay.
Yep. Yeah, it was when it got raided. And he said,
it's what Glenn Beck always
says, no,
whenever there's a big outrage, look behind the other hand.
Yeah, it's smoke and mirrors. It has been for years. I mean, anybody who follows...
All right, kids, thanks so much for joining us here on this episode.
You're welcome.
Of We Are Libertarians. Thank you, Tad, for coming on.
Yes,
thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being here, Greg.
Thank you, good sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg, for the Cedar Creek Two-Hearted.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we did better than last week.
I thought this was a good episode.
Yeah, who was on last week? Bittner?
The live show.
Never Bittner. I thought that show was good, but it was fine. But
it was a somber topic in front of a live audience.
Oh, it was 9/11. I listened to it on the radio. I apologize for not being there in person. I was caught up in Game of Thrones. I just started watching when I got home on my vacation.
All right, a special thank you to our donors, our subscribers at the $100 a month level, Jason Doolittle, Craig DaCosta, and Christy Avery. You guys are awesome. You can become a monthly subscriber at $1 a month, $5 a month, and you get access to the private RSS feed where you get all of the special bonus content. Harry and I did an hour on the Facebook controversy where Facebook sold $100,000 of ad to Russian agents, and Harry and I break down why it's complete bullshit. And that was almost an hour of extra content that didn't get put in the free feed that you get on iTunes. You get you got special episodes of Greg and I doing Leading Liberty, and you always get a little extra at the beginning and end of each show. So that $5 a month, you really get a lot of cool content. $10 a month, you get access to the private group where you can watch the live stream and participate in the show. $25 a month, we're going to give you two posters that are autographed, and then there's a forthcoming meme database that Greg's going to have done real soon.
770 so far saved.
And we're going to...
Actually in an Imgur gallery.
Awesome. And then we're going to have that for you. And $100 a month, Craig and Jason are very close to getting their spot on the show. They're going to come on the show.
I can't wait to have them on. Looking forward to it.
So thank you for joining on this episode. You can you've turned your mic off and you're talking into it. You have the opportunity to help us grow this network by doing that, giving a monthly contribution or monthly subscription. We're giving you something back. We're putting out more content than we ever have before. That's why I'm very tired right now, but it's so worth it, and we're loving every minute of it.
It's fine.
And you can,
it's fine.
It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's neat. Last night, I recorded an hour and a half with Johnny from the Johnny Rocket Launchpad, Mark from the Lions of Liberty, Roger Paxton from the Lava Flow, and it's the League of Liberty podcast that will only be heard by our subscribers. So if you're in that $5 a month, you're going to get to hear that monthly show with this all-star cast of libertarian podcasters.
Do they hate me?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
I don't know why you'd think that.
Well, they never want to do anything with me, collaboration.
No, that's probably just me not wanting to bug you.
The schedule?
That's honestly what it is.
Gotcha. I thought I had been so mean to Roger Paxton and his Liberty LARPing friends up in New Hampshire that it had reached the point I can't even be the opposition.
No, it is genuinely just me not wanting to take up more of your time.
Oh, yeah. No. I appreciate it. I just wanted to make sure I hadn't eroded relationships to that level.
No. Roger loves that. He loves to purity shame us.
Yes.
So, but he has invited us out to Porkfest, and I may go, actually.
Well, you know, if you listen to Roger Paxton in the Lava Flow, he predicts that the world ends on Saturday too.
Right.
That is, no one is more pure than Roger.
No podcast is better than this amateur volcano podcast called the Lava Flow with Roger Paxton.
You know,
so you next time you only give Tad one beer.
I know not what I've done.
he's apparently pre-gamed because two beers in, he's shit-faced. Tad always finds a way to get very drunk by the end of an episode. And then there's like this like standoff where I don't know that I can drive. I'm like, I don't think you can stay here.
Thank God for Uber.
Yeah. No, he's fine. He's just being
I've
a punk.
A horse.
He's
you
got
don't
a,
need
whole
a license
horse.
To ride a horse.
That's right. So this is a really awesome show. It was. It took us about 10 minutes for us to get our bearings because you've got four lead guitarists. But then it really kicked in. We started arguing about Sarwark versus Tom Woods, and it was
well, that's easy.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear their perspective. So you're going to love it. And we're just doing this together. It's something we wanted to do, and now that we've all got subscribers, we want to bonus you guys for being subscribers. So that will be out next Wednesday. You can hear that on the end of September of 2017 in that bonus feed. You get to listen on the Patreon app. You get to listen on the RSS feed. So, really cool. If you're a big fan of this show and you're a fan of what we do, help us grow it. I was able to interview my first, not an employee, but I'm thinking about working with somebody and doing something different and cool. So, and you guys are making that possible. So, thank you so much for that. And stay tuned because we're I'm working on a lot of big stuff that this subscription money is allowing us to do. Thank you for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. We love you, we appreciate you, and we thank you so much for listening. And we apologize for this episode, so next week we promise
to do better next time.